Da tror jeg vi går i gang. Hjertelig velkommen til det månedlige medlemsmøtet i NUB Oslo. Mitt navn Petter Engelsen, er en av de som organiserer de her møtene.
Jeg er deltakerliste på tur rundt for å få oss til å vite mer om hvilke temaer som er interessant. Og hvis noen har lyst til å få vite mer om møtet, så er det bare å sette kryss og føre opp e-postadresse der. Etter møtet så går vi opp til Alexandros for å få oss en matbit og leske strupen. Alle er hjertelig velkommen å være med dit. Neste møte er ikke planlagt ennå, så hvis noen har forslag til tema for mai-møtet, så er det bare å ta kontakt. And then I'll switch over to English to make it possible for everyone in the room to understand me. Today we have been privileged enough to get someone with deep knowledge about system administration, written a few books about system administration lecturing at the University College of Oslo, and a PhD now with system administration as the task or topic, I believe. I welcome Eileen Friesch.
Hi. Do I need to stay in the camera's frame?
No.
No. Great, because I can't reach the mouse from the camera's frame. this could be... All right, look at that screen, because I'm going to be standing in front of the screen based on the cable lengths. Okay, hi. My name is Eileen Friesch. I live in Connecticut, in the U.S. usually, but I'm here for a semester, January to June, teaching at the University College in their... master's degree program in system administration. Connecticut is near New York City, if you're not familiar with U.S. geography, which I'm not that familiar with Norwegian geography, so I know where Tromsø is, I know where Stavanger is. So. I've tried to learn all the provinces, or fylke, but I've not yet succeeded. But anyway, so tonight I'm going to talk about Kerberos. Kerberos is something that I've been interested in learning more about for a long time, and it's not something that I have a lot of experience with, so I actually took this opportunity to learn more about it. So hopefully you're not all Kerberos experts, otherwise this is kind of not going to be the greatest thing. How many of you are using Kerberos? Great, a few of you. All right, so if I say anything wrong, feel free to correct me. I hope I won't, but I stayed away from the dark and scary corners. Kerberos really is the right way to do authentication security, and I've been convinced of that for a while. But it's a bit of a, it's not terrible learning curve, but it's a bit of a barrier to getting started. And a lot of places still aren't using it. For example, at the college, they don't use it. Does Oslo University use it? Anybody hear from there?
Active Directory,
sir. Okay, not counting on the Windows side. All right, yes, they use it here as well. It's used at Oslo University. Okay, but it's not used campus-wide. Well, I visited a university in California, Stanford University, and they have an amazingly beautiful infrastructure. They have Kerberos doing everything. Everything's Kerberized. They have AFS. They have web services, all with a single sign-on, and they've integrated their Windows domain tree into that as well. And so, really, it works at these extremely large levels because they have 60,000 students, 20,000 faculty, 15,000 staff. I mean, it's a huge community spread over 10 square miles. What is that in kilometers? 40 square kilometers, something like that. Anyway, so Kerberos. The slides are available at this URL, a PDF, and I'll put the actual, there's an animation later. I'll put the actual presentation file up later. Okay, so what does Kerberos mean? I always start with names. Greek, Kerberos, emphasis on the first syllable. The Latin is Cerberus. It's the three-headed dog that serves as the gatekeeper to hell. That's kind of an interesting metaphor, right? I mean, gatekeeper's good, but I don't really think of, I don't like to think of my work as hell, although oftentimes I do, but it's not my first, it's not my ideal. Here's some pictures. I love this one, right? Okay, three-headed dog with a collar. I mean, what's up with this? On one of the heads. So this is certainly how we think of it as these very fierce dogs, but I don't know what's up with the collar. And you'll notice that the tail is a snake. That's one of the attributes. I also like Blake's version. This is from the illustrations to Dante's Inferno. And you'll notice here that the paws are more like hands, and they have people grabbed. And that's appropriate, because Kerberos isn't something that will bite your head off. It just keeps you from getting in. And then, actually, an anatomically correct version, based upon Homer, is a snake for a tail, and then also the dog is supposed to have a mane of snakes also, so it's sort of part dog, part weird lion. Okay. All right, so why Kerberos? Well, I see I'm not the only person who remembers what VAX VMS is in this room, possibly. Meaning I'm not the only person over 50. So there, back in the good old bad old days, there was no, I mean, first of all, there was a time when there was no network, right? There was no LAN. You just had a bunch of computers around, and they couldn't really talk to each other. But once there were LANs, how did you coordinate user accounts? Well, you used rsync or something like that, or some scripts. You would rsync the password file, the host file, etc. And in order to have a single sign-on, you'd use something like rsh and rlogin with this mechanism of etc. host.equiv, which basically said if the same user on the remote system has an account on the local system, go ahead and let them come in without a password. Okay. And you would use rlogin, rcp, etc. What was the problem with that? Well, all the passwords were in clear text. Okay. That's a problem. Okay, so MIT in 1983 basically wanted to solve a whole bunch of computing problems. They wanted a single sign-on, they wanted to secure remote access, they wanted network file sharing, they wanted a graphical user interface, they wanted naming conventions for data storage and a directory service. So they went to a couple of hardware companies and they got a lot of money. DEC gave them $50 million, for example. Which sounds like a lot, and in 83 it was a lot of money, but when you think about what we got out of that, it's kind of amazing. So, single sign-on and secure remote access, that's Kerberos. Network file sharing, what's that? It's AFS eventually. It starts out as something called, I forget the original name, I'm blocking on it now. Graphical UI, what's that? Excuse me? It's X, the X window system and the XAW widgets. Naming conventions and directory service? Well, 3 out of 4 ain't bad. That was something called Hesiod, which didn't win. Something called OpenLDAP did win. And they actually also had the earliest known instant messaging service, which was, I forget what that was called also. So the first three versions of Kerberos were simply strictly internal to MIT, but in the late 80s, Kerberos 4 was released and started to be used at other sites. And then in 1993, came Kerberos 5, which is the version that we're still using, and the RFC is 4120 for that. People about who use Kerberos are passionate. So our mission is to establish Kerberos as the universal authentication platform for the world's computer networks. We foresee a day when Kerberos-based authentication and authorization will be as ubiquitous as TCP/IP-based networking itself. Okay. Well, we'll see. So like all good things, you have to form a religion around it, right? It's not enough to just have it. And if there's a religion, then you have to have sects that can fight with each other over nothing. And we have that. Why? Well, the slide is, oh my God, there's a munition in there. MIT is, of course, in Boston in the United States. And the United States government at one point decided, oh my goodness, we cannot let DES 56-bit out of the country because it will just destroy our national security and our standing militarily in the world. Okay. Except for, of course, you could put it on a t-shirt with one line of pearl. But, yeah. Well, you know, the problem is the U.S. government never asks me before they do things. They have never once asked me stuff. I could have told them that was a bad idea, but they didn't listen. So, all right, so some Swedes at the Swedish Institute of Technology said, all right, this is ridiculous. Let's make our own version. So from Kerberos version 4, patch level 9, was something called eBones, which MIT was sort of spinning off to be a slightly different version of Kerberos, which SIT took and made something called TGHKRB, which eventually became Heimdall Kerberos on March 17th, 1997, version 0.0a. You have to admire their level of specificity. So slide aside, who is Heimdall? You guys are all Nordic, right? Or most of you. So you know who Heimdall is? Heimdall is the god, or the Æsir, I guess is the name, who guards the Bifrost Bridge, which connects Midgard, which is Earth, and Osgard, which is the god's home. Okay. And he stands there and he guards it, but really he doesn't really guard it, because it turns out all he's going to do is he's going to blow the Jarlahorn, and I may be mispronouncing that, which will signal the start of Ragnarok. I probably butchered that as well. What is Ragnarok? No, only the gods go to hell, right? We get to live. You know, it's the overthrow of the gods, and most of the gods die, including Odin and Loki and Thor, and all those good guys die. And humans take over, and only a couple of gods survive to start a whole new age. Okay, so interesting choice of name again, but there you have it. But in all religions, there can't be just two. There have to be three, right? So there is MIT Kerberos 5. There is Heimdall Kerberos 5. And there is, anyone? What's the third implementation of Kerberos? There's more, actually. But what's the third major implementation of Kerberos? In fact, it has the biggest install base. Someone mentioned it earlier. Seattle, Washington's Active Directory. Yes. So we have three more or less interoperable, not horribly incompatible versions anymore. Okay, used to be worse. Heimdall and MIT have slight configuration differences, which is actually just enough to really bite you if you know one of them and not the other. But okay, so why Kerberos? Well, it is a single sign-on. You sign on once. You can use services and systems throughout the network without having to sign on again for usually around 7 days. There is no password data sent across the network, none, not even in encoded or encrypted form. It scales to even the largest sites, and it has excellent support for even heterogeneous environments. Kerberos is based upon a Kerberos server. Now, colloquially, this is called the KDC. KDC stands for Key Distribution Center. And in fact, that's one of the three main servers that a Kerberos server provides. But colloquially, everybody says it's the KDC. Okay, so technically, it's not the KDC. KDC is a third of what it is, but people call it the KDC. So I always think of it as a Kerberos domain controller, which shows, oh my god, she has Windows in her blood, too. Yes, I am bilingual. Okay, so there are actually three servers. One is a database server handling keys, the KDC proper. The second is called the authentication server, and it handles initial user authentication. The third is called the ticket granting server, which is what allows the user to use resources throughout the network. Okay, in terms of, that's talking about one server. Kerberos does scale well, even on modest hardware, even with just one server, because the network messages it uses are tiny. The CPU requirements are tiny. And there's generally only one access per user per service, and possibly even less. That's the maximum that you'll have. Okay. So it has support for master and slave servers, and server-to-server replication, and all the kinds of things you expect in any sort of distributed data service-based feature. Okay, Kerberos jargon, a realm. A realm is, I define it here, as a single Kerberos infrastructure implemented by a designated set of servers. It's a Kerberos site in more common things. The name is typically the uppercase version of the DNS domain. So my example is going to be ahania.com, all uppercase, which is actually one of my domains that I use for examples, but that it's a real domain that I actually own. Let's see how we're doing, yeah. Okay, a principal is a user account or a host in a Kerberos database. Okay, it's an entity which uses authentication services. A ticket is an encrypted message authenticating user identity and authorization for access to a host, network, or service. Okay, and it's technically a data structure in memory, and it might be stored on disk in a cache, but it's just some data. Do y'all know what Disneyland is? Disney World? Okay, again. Disneyland now, I think it's one price to get in. But it used to be, and maybe it's true here at theme parks, you paid one price to get in, and then some rides you had to actually pay an additional thing to get on the ride. Anybody familiar with that concept? Okay. All right. So a ticket-granting ticket is like the entrance. Okay, you pay to get in. Now, once you have a ticket-granting ticket, you can do some things with that. Some things in the park are free. A service ticket is to get access to a specific service at a specific location. So you can think of that as the e-ticket you used to need for Pirates of the Caribbean, or the tickets that you need for the good roller coaster, which has an extra prize from the entrance. Okay. So now what I want to do is look at some high-level views of user authentication and service access. How does Kerberos actually work? Okay, so what we're seeing here is we have a user workstation in a Kerberos realm. I walk up to it, I want to log in. So it's going to ask me for my password as usual. And I enter a password. Password is "and I wonder, but not for long." All right. Now, that password is used as an encryption key. So we make a hash of that password, and we create a key, which I'm calling KP, the key based on the password. And that's used for encryption as follows. We store KP on the user workstation. We create a network request, which is called an authentication request. It includes the username in the clear. This orange is the data, and this yellow is the encryption key for that data, if any. It also includes the current time encrypted with KP, the password hash. Okay, so I send to the KDC my username and an encrypted version of the time. And specifically, I'm going to talk to the authorization server on the KDC. Now, the KDC also knows the hash user passwords. Okay, when you create a principal for that user on the KDC, you give it the password. It also holds something called the ticket granting services key. This is sort of the master key, which is used to make all other keys. So it has the password and the ticket granting key. Now, because it has this password, it can decrypt this, right? It knows the passwords. And in fact, this workstation doesn't even have to know the passwords. The user enters something, whatever that something is used to encrypt the time, and it's sent to the KDC. The KDC knows who the user is, because that's in the clear, looks up the hashed password for that user, uses that to decrypt that message. If it gets a valid time, and the time was within 5 minutes of the time it has locally, it assumes that it's valid. Okay. If, however, let's say the user mistyped their password, what's going to happen? They will have encrypted the time with a different key than the KDC is going to use to decrypt it, and so the KDC will get garbage, and so it will reject a request, okay, and just say it fails to authenticate. And in fact, because it gets an invalid time, it can even probably tell the user that that was a bad password. Okay, so the nice thing is you don't need the passwords all over the place. They can be one secure place, and the password doesn't have to go across the network. It just gets entered here. It's not even in memory, and it's just over here. Okay, once the time is okay, the reason that you check the time is so that someone doesn't like sit on the network and watch these packets and then just resend them. If they were good forever, like for an hour, someone could resend the same packets and get access even though they don't know the password. That's called a replay attack. Okay, the Kerberos server then creates a new key called the session key, which I'm calling KS. And it creates a response back to the workstation. It consists of the session key encrypted with this same password-based key that the user's workstation knows, and also the session key plus some authentication data, which is the username, also the time, and some other stuff, encrypted with this KTGS key. Okay. Now, only it knows the key. The user cannot decrypt this last part, but that doesn't matter, as we'll see. So when this arrives back at the user workstation, the user looks at this part, says, okay, I know this key, decrypts it, and then saves the session key for later use. It looks at this part and says, okay, I don't have KTGS, but I can just save this as is. And that is, in fact, called a ticket-granting ticket. Okay, a ticket-granting ticket is basically something that you can show proving that you have purchased a ticket. If you'd like to see a ticket-granting ticket, I can actually show you one. This is a ticket granting ticket, right? It's a monthly card. It's not good forever. But I can show this, and I can essentially get a virtual ticket for any single ride I like. Okay, so that's how the initial authentication passes. So how do we know it's the right password? Because the Qrveros server compares its results with what was sent over, and it decrypts to a reasonable value. Any questions about that? No. Okay, now how do you use a Qrveros service? We start at the same state we were on the previous slide. We have the KPKS, which is the session key and the ticket granting ticket. The user will now send another request for its access to this service over here, which specifies the server service in the clear, the user and the time with encrypted with the session key, which is what we got when we initially authenticated, and then they'll just send the ticket granting ticket back as is. The Qrveros server, this time the ticket granting service part of it, still remembers the session key, so it can decrypt all of this. It can verify the ticket granting ticket is valid because it knows KTGS. Make sure nothing has been forged. Once everything passes, it creates, it also actually knows the specific server key, KV. So it's going to create a ticket for this service for that user. So it creates a service session key, which is the ability to use this service for a certain amount of time, which it again encrypts with the session key. And then it encrypts authentication data and the same key with the server's key. Now, once again, the user knows the session key, so they can take out the service key. Doesn't know this key, so they just, again, save the service ticket as is, unencrypted. Then when they want to actually use the service, they send the service ticket over here. Okay, what's the purpose of this? We want to get this KS key, SK, which is the service session key, both here and here without it ever being on the wire, unencrypted. All right, it sends that to the server. Because the server does know its own key, it can decrypt it and it gets the session key out and it knows who it belongs to. It stores that away and waits for requests. And then once we're done, these guys can communicate using that now shared secret key. Questions? Okay, it's very elegant, okay? And what's cool about it is what's not there. You can't sniff something that's never on the wire, right? You're not gonna lose any passwords this way because they're never there. It's far more secure than any encryption method. Okay, some additional details. Transactions for authentication can require pre-authentication. That means requiring the user to prove knowledge of the key, i.e. the password, before granting the ticket granting ticket. Okay, and that's what we just saw. That's how Windows always works. That's how the other Unix and Linux-based Qrveroses work by default. But you also have the option of using a PKI, a public key infrastructure, so you can actually just have public keys. So you don't have to have passwords at all if you don't want to. Tickets also have a number of properties. They can be renewable. So in general, the initial expiration time is 10 hours, but it can be renewed a bunch of times up to a maximum of 7 days. Those are the defaults. Okay. A ticket can be forwardable, which means that if the user goes to a new client, it doesn't have to get a new ticket for that client. It can use the one from the previous client. Okay. These are all options. It can be proxyable. So the user can send a ticket to the service, and then the service can use that ticket to request other services on behalf of the user, okay, acting as a proxy for the user. And it can also be post-dated, which means that it's not valid now. It'll be valid someday in the future. And that's if you're using something like a batch job. There's some security safeguards. There's actually a ton of them, but just at this brief level, we talked about replay attacks. Using the time prevents most replay attacks. But the KDC can also maintain a replay cache where it actually checks recent tickets and sees if it's seen them before, so it doesn't solely rely on the time. So if you need an extra level of security, that's an option. Something like this can always be potentially susceptible to man-in-the-middle attacks. That's where somebody sits in the middle and instead of you going to who you think you're going to, you go to this guy who's sitting in the middle who pretends to be the server to you and pretends to be the client on the other side. Okay. In general, the Kerberos RFC says that that's the client's responsibility, but one of the ways that you can make that much, much likely is to make sure that the DNS servers are extremely well protected. So that the way that the client finds the Kerberos server is not subject to any sort of data corruption or data injection. Okay, so sounds good. How many of you want to go install it? All right, thank you. All right, so how do you do that? Well, there's some prerequisites. Then you install and configure the KDC, not surprising. You add principals, i.e. users. You maybe expand the infrastructure if you have a lot of users to more than one server. Then you install and configure clients, and then you install and configure servers for services. Okay, the examples I'm gonna use are MIT Kerberos on Debian for this ahania.com. And in fact, I've done this with VMs, but doesn't matter, works either way. So the prerequisites are DNS, with both forward and reverse zones fully working, and the host name must be the fully qualified domain name on each server where it's gonna matter. Okay, that means both in DNS and in et cetera hosts and in files like et cetera host name, that's what Debian uses, but whatever you're using, you have to have it always, host name 3 should return the fully qualified domain name. NTP, which is network time protocol, you need to have, if you're gonna worry about this 5-minute window, you better make sure your clocks are synchronized. So you at least need to run something like NTP date server in cron and at boot time in something like rc.local. If you're going to use LDAP, you need to be running LDAP version 3, but LDAP is not required. All right, then you need to add some DNS server records. Server records are something that are used a lot in the Windows world, but not as much in the Linux world. But Kerberos is one example of something that uses it. Basically, what they say are, is if you need a certain kind of service, where is the server that handles that? So the format is service dot protocol dot identifier. So in this case, it's Kerberos dot TCP or UDP dot realm name. And remember, the realm is just the DNS domain uppercase. Okay, so Kerberos, UDP, and TCP have server records. There's also an administration server. It runs on TCP and a password. Sometimes you'll see the password, which runs on UDP. Yeah?
Is that really the realm name or is it the DNS name? I see you end with a dot. Will that avoid adding the DNS domain name at the end of it?
Yeah.
So it wouldn't really work?
No, you don't want the DNS name at the end, I don't think. You want the realm name. I think it actually works either way. I've actually seen instructions to do it both ways.
To find it in DNS, it has to be in the right domain.
Right. All right, I could be wrong about that. It could be that I'm supposed to have, that these dots might be wrong. I'll look about that and I'll get the slide corrected when I put it up on the web. Thank you. Okay. Anyway, these are server records. This field is the priority, and that works exactly like the MX records priorities do. So a bigger number is less likely. So you can have more than one server for a given entry here. 0 is the waiting, which is seldom used, and then this is the port number. So the Kerberos general port is 88, although it also uses 750. 749 is the administrative port, and the password port is 464. KDC is the host I'm using. It would be better to have the fully qualified domain name, but I cut it off here just because of the slide. Okay, then you build the software, or more likely you install the packages on Debian. These are the packages that you need. And the ones with stars are the ones you need on a client. The ones without, the ones in this level up before the space are what you need on a server, and the ones with stars are what you need on a client. All right. I don't know why it's broken in so many pieces. If you build from source, obviously you just need one thing. This is the actual KDC server. This is the runtime library. These are the config files. This is the administration server. These are some user-level utilities, that's documentation. These are some Kerberized clients for things like FTP and Telnet, and this is the PAM interface. Three main configuration files. etc.krb5.com is general settings. You'll see that on both a server and on a client. etc.krb5kdc, kdc.conf is the KDC configuration. And same directory, kadmin5.acl lets you set administrative access control, who can do what to principals in the realm. Okay, so here's an example of the first one, which is the general Kerberos configuration. There's more stuff in there, but this is sort of the part that you would need to modify if you were setting it up for the first time. You specify the realm in various places, the default realm. You give a stanza under realms for your realm where you say what the KDC is, where the admin server is, and the default domain. In the file that you get when you install, there'll be a whole bunch of other realms for things like MIT, and there's sort of some publicly available Kerberos realms that you can use, I suppose, for connection testing. I don't know. I usually delete them in mine because I don't actually want those to be accessible. Here's where you map DNS domains to the realm, and then finally you specify locations of log files. Yeah?
If you specify the entries in DNS, why do you need to specify them again there?
I don't know the answer to that. I have not looked at the code. You do have to specify them both places, though. I have learned that the hard way. Okay, where am I? Yes, you should, one ought to not have to do that, but in order for the KDC to function properly, it does have to know that. I guess maybe it's, now that I'm thinking this off the top of my head, so I don't know if this is correct, but it might be an infinite regress problem. The KDC has to know what domain it's in, so it can't go ask the DNS how to find itself, if that makes any sense. So maybe it knows, yeah. I don't know, sorry. KDC.conf is, actually, that's not right. Come back. Yeah, this is actually under etc.krb5kdc/kdc.conf. I'll fix that typo as well. This is the actual server configuration. Specifies the ports. The only thing you have to change in here from the default is you have to put your realm here instead of whatever it comes with. Although I actually had to add these port numbers in mine. For some reason, the one that Debian distributes doesn't have those in there, and they are required. Okay. Once you've done that, you create the realm. Basically, what does that mean? It means you're creating the database that all this stuff is stored in. User sbin kdb5_util. That's easy to get wrong. Also, learned the hard way. Everything else is krb5. This is kdb5. Create minus s says I'm going to be using, says go ahead and create the realm. It asks you for a master key, which you need to remember. And in fact, the master key is the password corresponding to this principal. And the database files themselves live in varlib krb5kdc. That's on Debian systems, again. I think the default when you build MIT from source is everything's under user local somewhere. But I'm not sure. Now you need to add principals. So you've got a domain controller now, or a key distribution center, a Kerberos server, but you have nothing in it. So there are two utilities, kadmin.local and kadmin. Kadmin assumes that it's talking to the administration daemon, kadmin-d. Okay. Kadmin.local is a version of that will talk to the database only on the KDC that doesn't require the server. All right, so when you're first doing it, you run kadmin.local. After that, you always run kadmin. So for example, the convention is username, role, and then realm. Okay, so here it's Eileen/admin, meaning in an administrative role at the realm ahania.com. Eileen@ahania.com is an unprivileged version of that same account. They're separate principals, and they can have separate passwords. All right, so there's a simple subcommand to kadmin, add principal, Eileen/admin, and it'll ask for a password twice. Okay, so a cool way to test this is create a principal for some test user, joe@ahania.com, or I guess I'm in Norway, so my default guy is always odd@ahania.com. Give him a different password here than over on the server where you're trying, on the client where you're trying to test it. Because then you can see, once the new password works for him to log in, you know that you actually are talking to the KDC. Okay, kadmin has a variety of subcommands. This is in sort of C-shell list wildcard format. So add, delete, modify list, underscore principles. Same thing for policies, which are things like how often does your password have to change? What requirements does the password have in terms of contents? Things like that. There's also a change password command. Come back here, sorry. Stop that. And things that have to do with KT add and KT remove have to do with key tab files. All right, the third config file is kadmin5.acl, which is basically permissions. Who is allowed to administer the realm and create principles? There are six basic atomic permissions, A for add, B for delete, I for inquire, which is either to list items or to list attributes, M for modify, C for change password, and L for list, which is simply to look at the objects, not their properties. So, and a star is a wildcard. The format of this file is principle, permissions, objects. And if there's nothing in the objects field, it means any object. Okay. Or object expression. So here, root/admin@hania.com can do anything. That's a little bit unreal because generally you don't use root in Kerberos. Eileen/admin@hania.com can do anything to anything. And Chavez/admin@hania.com can add, inquire, change passwords and lists, any of the administrative principles in that realm. Okay, so it's a fairly simple file. The actual servers that are part of Kerberos, there are three main ones. KRB5KDC is the actual, it's actually the three servers. It's the key distribution center server, it's the authentication server, and it's the ticket granting server. Okay, kadmin-d is what allows you to do administration from a remote system. You talk to that daemon. And kprop-d is what does replication between master and slave servers, and it only runs on the slaves. There are a couple of other ones which are fairly obsolete at this point. KRB5-4d is if you have some Kerberos 4 clients, then you can. This is sort of a bridge between those. A lot of things change between Kerberos 4 and 5, and so this will serve those clients. And kadmin-d 4 is the version 4 version of kadmin-d. Fair number of client utilities. Kinit, useful when you're testing, that says talk to the KDC and get me a ticket granting ticket. So that's a way to see if you're actually even talking to the KDC. Klist shows you what tickets you have. So any user on a client can do that. Kdestroy removes a ticket. And kpassword lets you change your password. Although in modern Linux systems, once you've integrated this into the usual authentication, kpassword doesn't need to be run. The usual password command will call it. Okay. Then there are some Kerberized versions of standard clients. For example, here's an FTP. KSU, do you know what that, can you guess what that is? I see Kansas State University, but I'm pretty sure that's wrong. It's KSU. It's like, oh yeah, you might want Kerberos for SU. Probably not though, because you're using sudo, but there is a Kerberized version of SU. Okay, so that's a server. So how do you get a client hooked up? That's the hard part, that's most of the work. There are a couple of steps that are not in there. They're sort of optional and not required just for the basic functionality, just to let you know. I'll have some references at the end that have all the gory details for you. So on a client, same thing. You install the software. You install quite a number of packages under Debian. You configure krb5.conf just like on the KDC. It looks exactly the same. And then you add support for authentication and other services. So PAM is typically what you use on Linux. And there's a module, pam_krb5.so. There are actually several modules. There's one called pam_krb5_LDAP. There's one that is used with AFS. There's depending on what else you're using with Kerberos. But KRB5 is the basic one. Generally, the module comes before pam under unix_unix.so or whatever it is, Unix, Unix 2. There's a million names for the standard password module. It comes before that one. And this flag here, minimum UID equals 1,000, that says generally you would set that 1,000 to be whatever, wherever your user accounts start, so that you're not trying to use Kerberos for any of your system processes, which makes sense. Okay, so in common auth, this is again Debian, or anytime you're doing authorization, in fact, even on Debian, you have to change these four include files that Pam uses, and you also have to look at a couple of others. Login, I think, has some specific stuff, and SSH has some specific stuff. You would use sufficient, so if you pass Kerberos, you don't need to go on to ask for a local password. And in common password, you also use sufficient. In the account stack and the session stack, you can just use the word required. Kerberos, in fact, doesn't do much in those stacks because it really just does authentication. It doesn't worry about things like when your account expires or if your password is expiring or if you have any time-based limits on your account or anything like that. Okay, OpenSSH also, on Debian especially, has hooks for Kerberos. So this is, on a Debian system, you can use these three keywords. Do you want Kerberos authentication, yes or no? If Kerberos doesn't pass, do you want to allow a local password, yes or no? Do you want Kerberos tickets to be cleaned up when appropriate, yes or no? Okay. If you're using a different version of SSH that doesn't have Kerberos hooked in, you can still use the generic security services API, GSS. And what that is it's kind of an indirection layer for security. Basically, it's an API that an application can call whenever it needs authentication that hides the details of how the authentication is done. And so it gives you support for a lot of authentication mechanisms for free, because if GSS API knows how to do it, you know how to do it, with, even if you don't know how to do it. And GSS API can speak Kerberos, so if your application can speak GSS API, then you automatically can do Kerberos. So there are lots of versions of SSH which can get you Kerberos that way. The key things in the config file there are authentication and credential cleanup, which are sort of exactly the same as these two guys, the Kerberos ones. Okay, application support. So we talked about, you know, authentication a lot. Now, how do you set up an application to use Kerberos? Well, first of all, you have to find something where they have modified the application so it knows about Kerberos and tickets and things like that. And what you find a lot of easily is things like FTP and Telnet and RSH, and they don't operate according to the full model like I talked about. They don't have their own separate key. They basically piggyback off of the session key, and they basically use the session key as proof of authentication. They don't have their own service-specific session key. That's true of FTP, Telnet, RSH. It's true of NFS and Samba. AFS, it's not true of. Also, Apache and even IIS, amazingly, have fully Kerberized support. And the way that server-specific key gets set, generally, remember how the server had its own key that it was shared with the KDC? That's done by creating a principal for that service on that host in the KDC. Okay. It's as simple as that. So it's a one-line thing to get that going. Basically, all the work has to have been done by somebody else. From an assistant administrator's point of view, it's very easy. Okay. All right, so these are the basics. If you want to go beyond that, there's a lot more subtlety and corners to explore. One thing is key tabs. A key tab is a file that stores basically the key corresponding to a principal. It's part of the basic KDC infrastructure. Okay. Now, by default, all of that's stored in a single file. But if you're a very secure site, you actually can break those all out into per user or typically per principal files, so that it's a way of separating risk. So if one if one account, say, is breached, and God forbid, there's no interaction between the accounts if you have separate keytab files. Another thing you can look into is PKI integration. So if you don't want to use passwords, you can, and you have a PKI, you can have this fully integrated with that. How many of you have a PKI where you're working? Yeah, one person. Where do you work? Yeah. Was it hard?
I didn't set it up.
Okay. My sense is that that's something I would like to know more about also, that PKRs are non-trivial. Okay. Third topic of exploration is cross-realm trust. So this is for things, two ways that this matters. One way is Active Directory, because that's essentially a cross-realm trust. Active Directory always has its own Kerberos realm, regardless of what you've got set up. And it's much easier not to fight it. I know a couple of people that have tried to take Active Directory and put it into an MIT Kerberos. They gave up. Neither one of them made it. I don't know anybody that has succeeded in doing that. It's just not worth it. And the reason is Microsoft has made, okay, Microsoft hasn't actually broken any Kerberos standard, but what they have done is they have taken places that were unspecified or ambiguous and made decisions about what they meant. So they've something that was ambiguous, they decide, okay, it means this, and guess what? It didn't really mean that. Or they've added things, they've done extensions so that data structures now have additional fields. Okay, that's kind of broken, really, but anyway, not going to get into a different religious war today. Anyway, so that's one kind of cross-realm quest. But another kind is just, let's say you're at stanford.edu, and you want your users to be able to use resources at yale.edu. Okay, there are various, these are called federation services, when you basically have authentication in one realm, which is then applicable to a different realm. That involves Kerberos cross-realm trust. Okay, there's a project called Shibboleth. I don't know if you guys have heard much about it. It's in the US. It's sort of an open source, university-driven way to do these federations. I personally am from the corporate side, so I find all of this just appalling. You know, why would I want anyone from another realm in my realm? So, but that's just me. Okay, another area is replication and updating. There are master and slave servers. There are also differences. One of the differences between MIT and Heimdall is that Heimdall can do partial updates, whereas MIT does full updates. So it doesn't change. It doesn't send just the changes to the slaves, it sends the entire database. Now the data is not usually that big, so it's not horrendous, but sometimes that might matter. Also there are, I think, provisions to do read-only servers. So if you just have a huge infrastructure, and you just want people to be able to not do updates to all the servers, you just need lots of servers, or you're widely geographically distributed or something like that, there are those kinds of facilities. Finally, another thing is SASL integration. SASL, what does SASL stand for? I can't even remember. It's a generalized authentication and authorization system where it's just extremely flexible in what you can use for your authentication mechanism, what kind of encryption technologies you use, et cetera. And a lot of people use it for other things, and so they want to integrate Kerberos into that. It gives you more features. Basic Kerberos is fairly basic. It does authentication. If you need more sophisticated authorization services, so you want to just not only have, you want, for example, that Kerberized service to say, to have some sort of access control, whether or not this person can use that service, you need more than just Kerberos. Okay, more information. There's the URLs for MIT Kerberos, Heimdall Kerberos. There's an O'Reilly book, which is fairly old, but still mostly relevant. Jerry Carter, who's one of the SAMBUMP team members, teaches a tutorial on Kerberos. It's a half day at LISA and other conferences. And I'm going to be writing about Kerberos in my next version of my book, which will be next year. Hopefully I'll know even more then. Yeah.
Does this all map into ISO 27000?
I don't know. I don't know much about ISO 27000. What about you guys using Kerberos? Don't know much about ISO 27000 either. You want to tell us about ISO 27000?
Well, ISO 27000 is the international standard for security.
Right.
I was specifically wanting to hear about something I first heard about today. That's a governance part of ISO 27000, which is called 27014. And that seems to me very modern to have a governance module within your security system. And my impression, I mean, this is very interesting, but my impression is that governance of a large system would give you problems.
That seems fair. Okay, it's an international standard, by which, of course, we mean it's something that people outside the U.S. are doing because the U.S. won't cooperate, which is why I know nothing about IS 27000. Okay, that's what international means. Okay, there are many ways in which Europe is far more advanced than U.S. business processes, things like that. ISO 27000, which I couldn't have. I know what it is, but I can't come up with it. I couldn't have come up with the name myself. Banking. Okay, you guys don't even know what a check is, right? This little piece of paper, you know, I'm here, I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing, you know. Of course, it means that until you get your bank ID, you have no money, but oh well, you know, nothing's perfect. Anyway.
I was a child.
What? Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, that's what cash advances on your credit card are for, provided you don't mind paying lots of interest. Anyway, so that's, you know, you guys should tell us if Kerberos fits into that. And then you should get us to accept it. Because okay, that's all I had. Thanks for listening. Are there other questions? Yes.
One more for me. Can you tell me more about the forwardable feature? And another one, does Kerberos work well with the offline authentication method, the cache credentials PAM module?
Right, I don't know. The second part, I don't know if it works well with the cache credentials part. It shouldn't really interact though, right? Because basically, you're offline. Do you mean you're really offline, or you're out of your own home domain and you're somewhere else in the world?
Well, both. It should work in both settings.
If you're at another Kerberos site, try to think how that would work. I haven't thought about it, obviously. So I don't know. I'm thinking it's not going to interact that much, because it shouldn't come up. Because you've got the cache credentials, provided that Kerberos integrates. Okay, the question is, if Kerberos integrates with the caching, it should all work. Does Kerberos, I don't know. I would guess no, if I had a guess off the top of my head that it hasn't, that no one's made that connection. Okay, I'm blithering, I clearly don't know. I'm thinking out loud. What was the first part? Oh, more about forwardable tickets. Yeah. Okay.
Why do you need them?
Okay, they're on by default. Okay, if you don't have them turned on by default, every time you go to, then your ticket granting, then your session key is only valid on your local client. Okay, now that doesn't matter if you don't move around much, at least within a session. But if you actually, you know, use resources on a third server for which you actually need, I know this is heresy, but consider it in the Windows world. All right, every time you use a shared network resource, you're actually doing a login, right? Then you want to have a forwarded ticket so that you don't actually have to log in again to use that network shared resource. Does that answer your question?
I think so, yeah.
That one I know. Second one I don't know. Any other questions? Okay, well, thanks for inviting me. It was fun to be here, and I will be staying.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah.
And now we are heading over to Alexandros.
Oh, that's it? There's nothing more here?
There's nothing more here.
Oh, okay.